Hey everybody, and welcome to this meeting. Looking forward to this meeting with Jason for talking about shoes and technology and things like that. It's a privilege for me as the National President of ATFC to welcome everybody here, and I won't go into a lot now about Frank and Deb because they're not online and we'll see later on. But it's really a privilege for me to actually be part of these online meetings because, if there's one thing that came out of COVID, is actually the facility of online meetings to get together, and coaches can get together all over Australia and actually overseas as well. So please join me in actually giving a preemptive clap for Jason for his session that's ahead. So if everybody can just clap their virtual clap, that's it. And over back to you, Jerry.
Yes, so I'll do the introductions now of our presenters. First of all, we've got Jason, who's got associations with Australian Athletics, Victorian Athletics, and Melbourne Storm. He's a past lecturer at La Trobe University. He's a past podiatrist at Essendon AFL Footy Club and the Australian Open Tennis. He's a past host of health and sports science segments for Channel 9, ABC Radio, Triple R. And also, he runs a podcast, The Champion Within, which has got plenty of athletics talk. He's represented Australia in world cross country, and his PB for the 1500 was 3:45, 5K 13:48, and 10K 28:58. Now, Kirstine was originally invited to just be a normal participant, but she's an international official. She's also a life member of the Victorian and Tasmanian branch of ATNFCA. She spent more than 50 years in education, much of that time with School Sport Victoria, and she's received awards for multiple years of service in the spheres of officialdom and education. Upon receiving the invitation to be registered for this session, she offered to give an update on World Athletics shoe rules. And Jason's accepted her to do that, and he will invite her in when he's ready to have her participate in the presentation. So thank you very much to both of you for making yourselves available, and I'll hand over to Jason to start the session.
Oh, thank you, and thanks for having me again. And welcome to all the people who've got up early on a Sunday morning in the UK and elsewhere. This is a really interesting topic, and it has consumed, I think, the whole running fraternity over the last few years. And if we just take a second to think about where shoes have come from, being so simple in the, so let's say 70s, 80s, and then the 90s, we had the big fat shoes for shock absorption. And then even more recently, probably a decade ago, shoes went back to being super thin. And there was that trend of having shoes, a small, thin, to accentuate your muscular control. That was the whole barefoot running scene. And then from that, we've progressed to the other end of the spectrum where we have the super shoes and the trend of where shoes are super thick, thicker than ever before, and obviously designed completely different. And the interesting thing with this is, and the title says it all that John gave me, Benefits and Pitfalls, there are so many things that are not spoken about that the more modern running shoes impose on us as runners. There's certainly the benefits, but from a coaching perspective, I think it's worth enlightening, I suppose, where this fits in and how you can use it for your athletes. And I suppose that's my job as a clinician as well, is teaching people how to use these shoes if they are going to. So, in 45 years of being involved in running, just as a runner and as a practitioner, I think this is probably the most confusing stage of running shoe development that we've ever had, because we've got big, thick shoes, we've got thin shoes, we've got our conventional shoes, and everyone is so confused. But usually, what they do is follow trends. And when we see the marathon world record being broken by Sawi and Kajelcha and whoever else in the women's, they're holding their shoes there and they're promoting it. And of course, 9 out of 10 runners on the street or people that we're coaching, they want those shoes as well. And that sort of cascades down to the companies really promoting the super shoes, and then the shoe stores are funneling people into, this style of shoe or the super shoe, which makes it really confusing and really detrimental for most people, at least anyway. So we know that technology has changed. We've gone from like really basic footwear, which is really good, to the super shoes, and we'll go through the features of the super shoes as far as what counts and what is beneficial. And at the end of the day, for the point of view for you guys coaching athletes, what is the hype about and what really counts? What should we know and how should we be using these shoes if we're going to? So we know that in the past, shoes have focused on, well, initially shock absorption. That's when like Air Maxes came out, and I think Nike were probably at the forefront of that, the Tailwinds and through the shoes through the 80s, 90s. But then that shoes became very quickly focused on stability or controlling motion. And that's still in play now. Some people need those sort of support shoes. But now we have the shoes which are stacked up really high. They're carbon plated mostly. And the foam is of a sort of a new, it's a new age foam that does assist in, being super lightweight and responsive. And that's the key of these shoes is the quality or the type of foam that these super shoes or racing shoes have in them. Because it is new compared to all the other polyurethanes and EVAs that we've had forever that, everyone here on the screen would have been running in for years. Okay, so this is the Adidas one. This is the one that Kajalcha and Sawi ran in London. And it looks sort of quite outrageous, doesn't it? Like, if you look at the curve of that thing at the front, it's like, yeah, how am I sort of going to run in that? Sort of, and it's so stacked up as well. And then we've obviously got the plate in the middle of it. The big deal is the foam and how lightweight it is. And having a shoe which is about 100 grams is really, really light. And that's probably one of the keys about the special foams that these shoes are made with. Here's a Nike one. Nike probably started the trend, I think you could argue, with Vaporflies and Alphaflies. So this one's, like double the weight of that Adidas one, apparently. There's a lot of studies that show that, 100 grams of weight can actually have a significant influence on the work that you have to do while running. And that's because, even though it sounds so minimal, but when you swing a small weight at the end of a pendulum, which is, your foot on your leg or your lower limb, it's going to have a profound effect. But there is a bit of evidence that, 100 grams difference is, quite significant. This is the New Balance one. You guys probably would have seen all this. All the companies are producing, shoes which are thicker and certainly more rocked at the forefoot. The ASICS one's quite popular. And it's very similar design again, really stacked up, really curved. The On one, this is the Cloud Boom. Don't worry about so much with the upper. This one, the upper is 3D printed or sprayed in the shape of your foot. And but the big aspect of this is the curve at the front. You can almost see on this one, on this On shoe, how it's quite thick, and then it gets to under the black stripe at the front. Under the black stripe here, I'm not sure if you can see my cursor at all, but you can see how the foam goes quite thick and then quite rapidly it thins out to almost half or a third of the thickness to create this really accentuated rocker. And when you do run in these shoes, they all give you that assistance of staying up on your forefoot, but this one particularly for me felt like it was the best assistance out of the whole lot. Here's the Puma range, and obviously this is quite controversial at the moment with the Abby Steiner issue in the States, which we'll talk about a little bit because obviously I'm fascinated with the physiology of what happens with those injuries and the effect of shoes. But Puma all of a sudden are in the limelight because of the Steiner issue with her Achilles and her heel pain, and it's going to go legal apparently, from what I've read. Disagree and agree with some of it, which we'll go through a little bit, but talking about that briefly a little later will be important points from a coaching point of view. This is the Saucony one. Same thing, really stacked up, got a plate in the middle of the sole, and as you can see, it's quite rocket at the front. So they're the three features here is the stack height of the lightweight foam, the carbon plate, and the rocker effect of the shoe. It's almost like in this one, the second part of the shoe at the back where Saucony is written on the foam, it's almost like that sort of like a fill-in block for the shoe. So you're not going to sit down negatively tilted towards the heel. It's sort of like a superfluous aspect of some of these shoes because the real engine of this is the forefoot and the rocker. Kirstine, I'll get you to chat about this in a sec, but I pulled this out of the World Athletics sort of criteria of what should shoes entail. And they're saying that for spikes, the spikes shouldn't exceed 20 to 25 mil of the stack height of foam. But as soon as we go to the road events, the stack height of the shoe should be no more than 40 mil. And all those shoes that you've just seen, they vary from 36 to 40 mil. So there has been a limitation on that. They have also, World Athletics has put a limitation on whether you can have one or more rigid carbon plates in the shoe. And they've stipulated you cannot have more than one carbon plate in the midsole of a shoe. And that is, it doesn't matter whether the shoe just, entails the circumference of the foam or is right through the whole base of the shoe. But you can't have more than two plates in the shoe, which I'm not sure why anyone would want that anyway, because it'll make the shoe almost immovable. Kirstine, do you want to chat about that for a minute as far
Yeah.
as the World Athletics sort of regime that they've or compliance rules?
Yep, sure can. And also on the Zoom meeting is Richard Lavish, who's also a gold referee, similar to me. So Richard, if I miss something, jump in. All right. As of the 1st of January, the thicknesses have changed. So there's no more 25 mil allowed. It's 20 for track and field events and track race walking. It's 40 for road running, track and road race walking. And for cross country, it can be 20 mil spikes or 40 non-spike shoes. And for those that do it, mountain and trail racing is any thickness. Just an update that went through in March this year after the hoo-ha of the discus in Tokyo at the end of last year with the rain. Throwing shoes that come out of a circle, i.e., shot put, discus, and hammer, no longer at this point in time have any shoe regulations on them. They decided with, well, they let the discus throwers wear anything in that rain. There's a pelted rain for the whole competition. And there was no concernable advantage in having what thickness shoe you had on, as was shown at the World Championships. So at the moment, there's further investigation being done with that. It may come in the future, but at the moment, it doesn't cover shot, discus, and what did I say? Hammer shoes. But otherwise, it's 20 mil or 40 mil. And those measurements are taken from mid heel and mid forefoot. Yep.
It's a good point about the throwing. I think John, you asked me a question about that, and we'll touch on that shortly, talking about the thickness underneath your foot and the effect of that that nobody talks about, and none of the shoe companies will ever touch it, is that the thickness influences your sensory perception of the surface. And why you would want to spin around a disc, you know, I was there that night in Tokyo too, by the way. But why you would run down the javelin runway, throw the shot or discus with anything more than basically a little bit of foam to, you know, to protect your bare feet, is beyond me. So I'm not even sure why they even, you know, really see that as much of a concern, because I just can't see that. You know, I'm sure in no time, if they do fatten up the shoes for the field events, I'm sure in no time they'll end up back where they started.
It still remains for Jav, so the 20 mil thickness for Jav, but not the 3 out of a concrete circle.
Yeah. Just on, while we'll touch on this as well quickly, if you don't mind. I'm not sure who it was, sorry, excuse my ignorance, but someone just asked a question about the thickness, or how come we haven't seen any improvements in using particular spikes with high jump, triple and long. And I think that's the reason, which Kirsten's touched on, is the thickness of the shoes remain at 20 mil. We're not seeing, you know, the big foams in those events, which, you know, it sort of makes sense not to have it anyway. And also, when you don't have the thick base of the shoe, it's very hard to get that rocker effect, which is the one of the keys of assisting you with your running. If you don't have the thickness of the base foam of the shoe, you can't have that rocker. So I think that's why we don't see the shoes influencing some of those events. So the thing is, how do they work? Because I mean, you guys are going to have people asking you this all the time. The main thing is the foam. So most of the shoe companies, they're all using the same foam. So although there's claims that one shoe is better than another, and we'll hear that for, you know, the rest of our lives, it's really the foam. And the foam is all about the springiness and the weight. So we can have a soft, springy trampoline or a mattress to run on, and without the weight. And that's what the PVAX foam is all about. The carbon plate definitely acts like a lever, so you bend it and it springs back. But if you had that in a thin shoe, sometimes the shoes feel really hard if you're running mileage. And the third thing, and the main factor with this, is the rocker shape, the shape of the shoe under the forefoot extending to the toes. And for any of you who have run in these shoes, you cannot walk and run slowly in these shoes. They only are beneficial when you run up on your forefoot and you're really moving along. And that is a key point, I think, from a coaching point of view. They are only beneficial when you're running fast. And you'll get the assistance from the shoe in holding you up on your forefoot. If any of you have the opportunity to try it, it's worth trying because it feels amazing and you can feel the assistance. I recently ran around in one of the Adidas shoes. I had to go and buy it because everyone's asked me about it. And I remember running around the park near work one afternoon. I thought, I can't walk in this. I'm wobbling everywhere. I can't run slowly in it. But as soon as I bolted across the park for like 400 meters, it felt amazing. It actually felt like the old days, like standing tall and over the ground. And there is no doubt there was assistance with it. And the rocker is the key. So if you want to improve yourself, it's worth getting a pair, but they cost a bomb. So the PBAX is a special foam, certainly amazing chemistry behind it. You certainly use more without making the shoe heavy, and the weight is everything, which we touched on earlier. So that's where these shoes are brilliant. They're so lightweight. There's definitely a rebound and springiness to it. So we're just talking about the foam only, which can only help as far as energy return. And they certainly, you know, have been shown to improve, you know, running economy, these super shoes with the special foam. And they do feel cushioned, but they do feel fast and lively. There's no doubt about it. So that's the foam. The benefits, well, there's lots of studies, and I had a look at a whole lot of stuff recently because I knew I was doing this. And there's a range of summaries of all the studies that have concluded that there are benefits of running in the super shoes, and the range of performance, oxygen consumption, modeling of biomechanics and work done range from 2.6 to 4.2% better running economy. A lot of people say they are less fatigued running in these lightweight, thicker shoes, which is a really big factor. And if we think about the marathon, why has the marathon time, why have marathon times come down so much? And one of the points that people have speculated on is that if you're less fatigued and you can run more, well, you're going to be fitter and stronger, ideally, if you don't get injured. And the reports on some of the elite marathoners have, they've been running, extraordinary 250 Ks a week, some of them, which is extraordinary. I mean, most people would probably run, what, 150, 160, 200 Ks, but they're actually doing more than that, 240, 250. Is that another reason why people have just, running faster and faster and stronger over the marathon? But there's definitely been performance effects measured, and in the literature, there's plenty reported. What about the placebo effect? Well, 9 out of 10 runners at Melbourne Marathon here in Victoria, if you go to any of the big events, you see lots of people running around in these shoes, thinking they're going to run fast. They probably really do feel faster, but is it really going to make a significant improvement for them? Confidence is everything, of course, and as coaches, you know that. Is it just a psychological effect? I think it is for a lot of people when we think about other important factors of coaching and training that that people need to focus on. And there's no doubt all the records are set in these, Alpha Flies, Vapor Flies, the Adidas Evo shoe. All of the records have been run in these shoes. So on the road, it's been a significant, change, that's for sure. Now, this is the big part, and obviously clinically for me, this is important, but equally as important for you people. The risks are really interesting, and this is what we never talk about. As I said, we'll touch on the Abby Steiner case shortly because I think it's well worth knowing. But the injury risks are interesting. There are more injuries with the super shoes around hip and knee. And all the studies conclude this. And there's one recent study from last year, which was really important, following runners which were randomly assigned shoes over 6 months. And the one thing that was shown, there was more hip and knee injuries in these shoes. So I would put forward that if people are not strong enough or they're not using these shoes appropriately for fast pace, they're probably moving around and don't have the strength to control their postural control running. And maybe that's why we see knee and hip injuries. And if they're not strong enough and they're running slow in these shoes, they will be wobbling around with their lower limbs up on a mobile platform, moving around underneath them. And that is not a good thing for anyone. Unless you're up on your forefoot and running fast, there's going to be detriment in using these shoes. So they're only good for running up on your forefoot when you're at fast pace. The other thing is all these shoes are really costly. I think the Adidas one cost nearly $300 or something. One of them, I can't remember, is nearly $400. Maybe this is your On Boom. And the durability of them is quite poor as well because the foam is so low dense and so light, they don't last. And if they don't last, if people are using them for extended times, they will have that detriment of moving excessively or being placed into an unusual or new position of running, and therefore, contributing to their injuries. Not everyone can afford to have these. So is there some bias there? Is there is that sort of inequality there? I think there probably is. I mean, you go to school sports and all the kids have got them, and then you turn up to, the state and national meetings, and some people have got them and some people haven't. It's extraordinary the money that people will put into something that is probably, it's certainly beneficial, but there's more important things to focus on. So the pitfalls. The number one thing with this is, and it's very rarely spoken about, is sensory perception. When you run in the thicker, bigger shoes, you cannot feel the ground. So any of us can imagine that. If you run up and down the hallway now barefooted or in a thin shoe and then put your runners on, you can't feel the ground. So double the thickness of the shoes you're wearing when you run up the hallway, and you won't feel the ground. Like even more so. So there's less sensory perception. And that is crucial in placing your feet and legs in the perfect position for impact absorption, but also muscular control. So if we remove our sensory input, we remove the stimulus to turn on muscular control of our feet, ankles, and our legs. I hope that makes sense. Excuse me. So, if we don't turn on our muscular control quick enough, we tend to move excessively. And combined with poor sensory perception, slower turning on of our muscular control, we move excessively on a thick, unstable base, which is wobbling around underneath us. So, it's sort of twofold the impact. And this is why people get problems with feet, ankles, and legs with wearing these shoes inappropriately. The other point to make is with impact. Again, if you run up and down your hallway barefooted and then you put the thick shoes on, you can't feel the ground, you tend to passively strike the ground. And we know that increases impact and vibration through your lower limbs. So I hope that's easy to understand. If you can't feel it, you slap the ground harder. And the running biomechanics studies of footwear have shown that for the last 20 to 25 years. But we'll never hear that from the shoe companies. And very rarely do you read about all that, even the independent blogs and what's online. But these are really important points from a coaching point of view. So, yeah, and this is a young woman I sort of mentor, Sarah. And if you have a look at her shoe, you can see they're a little bit thicker than what they used to be. They're quite rocket at the front, but all the spikes tend to be like this, a little thicker now, almost like a distance spikes, but everyone's using them now for the quicker events, the middle of distance events, and certainly for the 5 and 10 on the track. But all the spikes have become a little thicker and they're adopting a little more rocker underneath the forefoot. And the foams are much better as well, certainly lighter. Great technique. And that's probably, I think the second most important thing a runner needs to focus on. And we look at that, hands in the right position, arms up. Perfect in that photo. Going back to injuries, I hope this is easy to see. So this is following a group of runners who wore different shoes for 6 months. The score on the side is percentage of injuries using four different shoes. Across the bottom here, you've got N, C, S, and U. That's N is neutral, C is control, S is super shoe. And U is a shoe which is like a U-shaped shoe, which is almost like this concave U underneath your foot, which is interesting. But just focus on, if you focus on the third column of each part of the graph here, so the line next to the black bar here is the super shoe. So you can see that the rate of injuries around the knee in the super shoe, which is 1, 2, 3 in from the left, is almost the same as the other neutral or control shoes. If we go to the Achilles over 6 months, and hopefully you can see my cursor here, this long line here, more than 25% of injuries over 6 months were of Achilles injuries using the super shoes. So we have, significant knee injuries, certainly significant Achilles injuries, and then around the ankle, the tendon problems of the ankle were higher with the super shoes. And interestingly, the back and hip problems were higher in the super shoes. So there's got to be an influence here on not just, foot and ankle and lower limb, and obviously the Achilles and calves, but postural control as well. So if you think, if we go back and talk about postural control and we focus on back and hip problems, if we run on sand or in a really soft shoe on, say, natural surfaces, you can sort of feel yourself sink down and move around. And it's harder work to actually run as well compared to being on a hard surface or a thin-soled shoe. And I'm sure that there's obviously a significant effect with your postural control and being able to be upright and running over the ground. And once again, that gets back to strength and control posturally, which, is crucial for great technique. So we're certainly seeing more injuries, and clinically and anecdotally, I can tell you, the people who get all these injuries of foot and ankle and lower limb, particularly calf and Achilles, they're the people who probably shouldn't be using these thicker shoes, and just running around, in their daily recreational running. They're made for to run quicker in at a fast pace. So the implications for you as a coach. I think if you have a fragile athlete, they're not for that person as far as injuries. It's going to affect your mechanics, and more importantly, how strong that athlete is and their injury history. I think is a decisive factor as to whether they should use, this new age sort of design. And obviously, the event is everything. If they're not running super fast for the majority of their training, they don't need it. But if they're running fast races, maybe 5K on the road or 5 and 10K, and certainly, really elite at their marathon pace, well, I think it's suitable. But I think you need to know your person, how their injury history is. Obviously their event is everything. And really, are they strong enough? Are these young people we're coaching and mentoring, are they strong enough to cope with it? We need to introduce them gradually if we do, like really slow changes. And we all know that biomechanically, any small change has a massive effect. You only need to consider that if you hit the ground 1,000 times every kilometer with 2 to 3 times your body weight, a little bit of change is going to have a massive effect over 1 kilometer and two and three and so on. Small changes have a massive effect. A really important one, I think, for the athlete, but also parents and everyone else around them who wants everyone, their youngster or wants their athlete to be an absolute legend before they're due, is they need to train properly. And the training is everything. And that's the hardest thing with running, I think, is the patient side of it, not looking for a magic fix or a magic assistance apparatus that is going to help you immediately. The engine has to be groomed, obviously. So that's really important to, I think, speak confidently with as far as. Shoes won't fix poor training or technique, and we need to, really, I suppose, impose that those points on the people around us and who we look after. The updates of research are really interesting. Most are showing conclusions very, very similar of injury rates, biomechanical changes, but it is interesting and it's worth staying informed. And hopefully you've got your access to your favorite online sources as well. So they've definitely changed the sport, but they're not a magic fix and they're not for everyone. The other thing is monitor for injuries, especially knees and hips, but on those graphs and what we see clinically, definitely calves and Achilles, which are the dead giveaways that people are obviously, not strong enough, using them too much too soon, or they're just, they're not using them for right pace of running. And obviously, with everything, we're using the technical changes thoughtfully, hopefully. My big thing is not just the event, but is the person strong enough? You need strength to cope with movement and the change of position without getting injured. So everyone may benefit from running fast in super shoes, but are they strong enough to cope with it so they don't get injured? There is so much reading and it's fascinating. Well, I'm still fascinated in it after all these years. It's endless, the reporting in the literature. Interestingly, from a gender point of view, more injuries with women than men. So we think that that is because of, width of pelvis, angle of legs, and there's more motion that creates rotation of the lower limb. And this is my young favorite on the left here again. And we're talking about technique. You saw the photo earlier, beautiful running around. And then look at her hands now, how they're turned in, turned down, and arms are low compared to the woman next to her, where hands are up still, sprinting in the last, this is the last 10 meters or so, but the last 50 meters. If you drop your hands and drop your hand or internally rotate your hands, drop your arms, you're not going to maximize your potential. And although you can be the fastest sprinter in the field, you won't reach your optimum pace at the end. And this happens all the time with this young girl I help out. She's the Australian record holder, by the way, now in 800, which is amazing. But there's so much in the tank. And when we talk about shoes, my thing is, I always throw in training is number one and technique is number two. And if we look at that, there's so much to improve upon as far as not being curved and rotated when it really counts. I don't care what shoe you're wearing, unless you get that right, you're not reaching your potential. Throw in another shoe, it doesn't matter. You need to get the engine and the chassis like rock solid. So these are the things. My parting thing points are fundamentals. We can't lose the fact that with training, there's a recipe of consistency, increasing volume, increasing intensity. If we don't get that right, and everyone rushes it from point one to point two, or particularly point two to point three between volume and intensity, they'll break down. Technique is obviously my number two on the list, which I think is poorly coached, but people need to focus on that. So, in summary, the shoes definitely improve running economy, especially at a fast pace. Absolutely no doubt. In my opinion, I think it's the 4 foot curve that counts, and we don't get that so much in the spikes and at a low level of foam. But at a high thickness level of foam of 40 mil or 35 to 40 mil, we get that curve, and that is a really positive effect. Injury risk is not reduced. It's not, this gold stamp of I can do whatever I want and run as fast as I want. So, and we know that the injuries may shift, to different areas as well. Nothing replaces training and technique. And we have to be strong to use these shoes. Now, this is interesting from a coaching point of view. And someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I've read and understand, this person, Abby Steiner, she was plagued with calf and Achilles injuries. And there's now a claim against Puma that Puma's design shoes. With the rocker and the carbon plate and all the special foam have accentuated or even caused her problems. Now, previous to this, she was plagued with injuries as far as Achilles and heel problems. And I can tell you now clinically, the heel bone at the back, where the Achilles inserts into, when we hear that there's what they call Haglund's deformity, where the Achilles pulls on the back of the heel, and on X-ray, the bony prominence forms from the Achilles pulling on the back of the heel, which is called Haglund's. That takes decades to create. It doesn't turn up overnight, it doesn't turn up over months, or even a year or two. The other thing also is with all these people at an elite level, and we've had the same thing happen at Melbourne Storm this year, there's always this need or a feeling of we can't waste time, we can't take time off, we can't let an injury get better. We've got Com Games coming up, we've got world titles in Beijing next year, the next Olympics are just around the corner. You know, we can't have blocks of time off. So we tend to rush the elites through. And we've had this year in the Storm team that I look after, exactly the same problem as this woman. And they rushed probably the best player in the NRL through, who's now had surgery, and I, in my opinion, incorrectly, and he's done for the year. And that's a major, major blow. And it's no different to this scenario or others. Now, the young woman I mentioned that I sort of help out a fair bit and mentor Sarah here, she's had exactly the same problem and she's now fine. Absolutely fine. Wearing the same shoes, we haven't changed anything. She's just taken her time, trained properly, and now over exactly the same problem with no rush. So it's going to be very interesting to see where this lands as far as Steiner taking on Puma and Mercedes, and you know, the whole re-evaluation of shoe design is going to be very, very interesting to see where it goes after this, whether that it just puts the fear in people. So, shoe tech benefits and pitfalls, great benefits, lots of pitfalls. So there's questions for you guys. Is there questions or are there questions regarding specific shoes and technology, injury risks and best practices? And from your end, are there any real world sort of scenarios that you can impart? So I hope that helps you out. And you can probably tell from my tone, I'm pretty direct about my opinion on this after so long, but that's how you get after a long period of time. Training
Well,
technique, footwear. So, thank you very much for listening to me, and I hope that helps you out and gives you food for thought at least, anyway. Thank you.
thanks,
Okay,
Jason. John.
I've been taking notes from the chat, so when you finish, Kirstine, I can direct to certain people who've written into the
Beautiful.
chat for further comment.
I think one thing I want to talk that Jason brought up was about the and I hope I've got the right term, the perception of hitting the ground with the thick soles. If I put my school sport hat on once again, you know, the primary school sports last year in Victoria, you know, you'd look at the footwear some of them had on, and there was a few thousand dollars running around that track at the time, like these big what my dad used to call clodhoppers. On these little kids who couldn't have been feeling what they should have been feeling on the track. And I was at the cross country at Bundoora yesterday, although cross country, the ground was soft and a bit different and was wet. But the under 10, similar. So the rain, I know Jason and I have had this discussion before. The range of shoes that is available for juniors, apart from what the little athletics ones has, from that little ath age group up until probably 16, 17, there's not a lot of great shoes around for them to choose from. They've become expensive. The number you can buy is narrowing, and it's becoming a problem for all the
It
reasons that Jason said.
is. And also just to carry on from that, I think it's probably the worst thing you can put a young person in is the fat, soft shoes, because they just don't have the strength to move over the ground well with them, you're not bringing on that sensory perception and that sensory input to turn on muscular control. And we want these kids to grow up and turn up to training and in our rooms at 8, 17, 18, 19, really strong. And you can't do that with, poor input. So from a youngster's point of view, it's crucial.
Absolutely. The other thing I wanted to mention, and as coaches, go back to your families and whoever comes to state or national championships. Two of my bugbears this year have been people not reading the rules, or the parents reading the rules and not telling their kids. The kids can read, by the way. And also understanding what a shoe check means. The World Athletic, as we know, World Athletics rules are written for the World Athletic events. All right. So the shoe rule really only applies to World Athletics Championships and the World Under 20. But of course, they apply for Olympics and Commonwealth Games. And they apply for our national Open and Under 20 events only. Only. If you have a 12-year-old running in an Under 20 event, yes, they have to comply with the shoe rule. All right. What happens in a courtroom, and I had the joy of being the referee up in Brisbane for a little while, was yes, the under 20 and open athletes, their shoes were checked as per the World Athletics rules. The younger age groups, we weren't checking the shoes, we were checking the screw-in spike bits because there are some shape of spike that are available in Australia that tear up our tracks. All right, so
Which are
Nike's bringing out a set of jab boots. The actual boot is fine, but they're bringing these fluted spikes in that we had to take out of all those jab boots. HeartSport did a raging trade on spikes because they rip up the track. There's one called the Christmas tree. There's two types called the Christmas tree. They must be pointing down. If they stick up, cut up the track. So there's a lot to understand about that, but every age group up to under 20 through state and national, yeah, we only do it a check of the things that screw in. We don't otherwise look at the shoe. All right. Under 20 and open events, we check both the shoe, and if they happen to have spikes in them, we check the spikes as well. So that gets a bit confusing because there's a lot of parents of underage athletes saying, oh, they didn't check the shoes, or they did check the shoes for my athlete who's under 16. Well, we only check the screw-in bit. So it can get a bit confusing. We're trying to make that more clear. We've been posting at call rooms, we've been posting up photos of what the spikes look like. We're going to actually physically have some physical examples mounted for everyone to see. But just remember the thing is if it's an open or an under 20 event and you have an underage athlete competing in those events, they are subject to the World Athletics Shoe Rule, as is any athlete competing in our World Athletics Gold Tour Challenge, which is our Mori Plant meet. I also did a check at a bronze meet down in Hobart as well. And for my sins, I've managed to be the shoe checker in Australia. I don't know why. So it's really confusing for parents. They think they're buying the best shoe for their underage athlete, but nine times out of 10, they're not, especially if they're running in flat, it's a race they can run in flats in, for all the reasons that Jason has given. Or they think they've got the latest technology in spike screw-in spikes, and they haven't. So the spikes that come out with them one are permitted in tracks in other parts of the world, but the tracks we have in Australia, no, they're not. So Richard, have I forgotten anything? He's quiet.
On
Oh,
mute.
maybe he's gone.
No, Kirsten, I think you've covered everything. I think just that it's important that athletes and their coaches and their mums and dads, when they do go to a national meet, they are fully aware of what the technical regulations are.
Yeah,
And the
absolutely.
technical regulations actually discusses and outlines the rules for the actual spikes themselves. Because as Kirsten mentioned, there are some tracks you are not allowed to wear certain. The spike itself the actual 7 mil, 9 mil spike is as Kirsten does damage the track, so be mindful of that. And also, obviously, the open under 20s, they have to comply with the rules. Now, with regards to what shoes are legal, there's a quite easy document in the Wheel Athletics website. You just click on the link and it just gives you all the shoes with regards to what are legal or not legal, and for certain events as well. So just be mindful. It's a pretty quick link to do that.
That's something I was going to say. I'll send it to John because I got that link converted into a QR code when I find the email. I'll send it to John and he can send it out to everyone, plus the link of where all the documents are on the World Athletics, in the World Athletics Library, because they're interesting reading and they're updated quite regularly. Other thing I want to bring up, an incident happened in Nationals in Perth last year. It wasn't the infamous triple jump shoe that happened at World Indoors, but it was a triple jump event. The kid was jumping in under 20, I think. He'd gone out with his mum to buy new triple jumps shoes, probably in the lead up to his state. I can't remember what state he came from. And they complied. But what in actual fact, they were under test. They were under review spikes, and between his state and the Nationals, they were taken off because they didn't comply. So he had actually bought new spikes that then didn't comply. It's an absolute minefield. The poor kid had to borrow someone's shoes but then jumped a PB, so it wasn't all bad. But, I've been talking with Tom at Athletics Australia about producing some 5-minute videos about, you know, what parents with students with para athletes need to do about check-in, you know, going to TIC and signing in, what you do at call room, where's the call room, what do you have to come in, you know, and what spikes look like, so that there's something that can be easily accessed for parents as well as the kids. Being the ex-teacher, I'm very much on the kids having the information, not relying on their parents or their coaches doing it. Sorry, coaches, but sometimes there are some coaches that get it wrong. Not you guys on the meeting, of course.
Just an aside also, Kirsten, going on the shoe check, for example, like the Morrie Plant meet is our gold meet in Australia. Mm-hmm. And the World Athletics requirement, being the technical delegate for that, they require us to check a number of shoes and submit that to World Athletics as part of the review of the meet. And Kirsten does a very good job of that with regards to getting the athletes. And it's a range of athletes, not just track events, but it's also field events and a range of track events as well with regards to shoe compliance. And part of the gold meet, we have to submit that to World Athletics as part of the report on the meet. So that is important for that. And also, we also do it for our bronze meets as well. So just be mindful of that as well.
The other thing I was going to suggest, and I don't know if it's a fault or not of the link, but when you use it, you can type in the name of the shoe which is written on the heel or on the front of the shoe, and it'll come up with some photos. That doesn't tell you that it's approved. It's just come up with some photos. You've actually got to go and look at the inside of the tongue of the shoe where it has the serial number, and that's what you need, and type that in. Hit enter and it'll come up with permitted shoe or not permitted shoe. So don't just be fooled by the name of the shoe, whatever that one was that the guy ran in the marathon. There's about three or four of them with that name. You actually got to go and look at the inside of the tongue of the shoe, pick up the serial number, put that in, and make sure you hit enter for it to assess it properly. So as I said, it's a minefield at the moment. Sorry, I've now taken over too many questions.
No, you're all good.
Anyone's got any questions about it?
All right.
I see there's a lot of information popped up about someone wanting to know about spikes and things like that. So,
I'm going to run through that now. Yeah, I'm just looking at the chat now. I've got it up. Andrew, you said you've seen lots of people get into trouble when they change sponsors, which is rarely considered. Absolutely. It happens all the time. The young woman I help out, she had an opportunity to change. Potential opportunity to change, and the answer was no, you stick to your guns of who you've been running with for years and years. That was a no-brainer. So you're right. Were the studies controlled for mileage? Yeah, but the shoes were randomly issued. Absolutely. Is there plated feedback some point of cause for this also? Yeah, there probably is, but I don't know. Hard to get some of the older shoes. Are they different? Okay, Brett said, are there different impacts on performance between men and women? Not performance, but injuries, yes. Legal aspect. Okay, then we got onto the thing, and PD's said a great comment about the Abby Steiner thing, which is fantastic that she was running in Nike forever and really thrashed herself in races and did so much, changed shoes, got injured, but also had lots of injuries and surgery before she had her Achilles problems. Remember that bony problem they're talking about takes years. The bone takes years to develop, and they're hanging their hat on something like that. So it's going to be interesting to see from a physiology point of view what is produced. Nike doing something that money from was not good. Gee, Nike doing something that they were money from or that they earned money from was not good for the sport. What a surprise. Availability, yeah, well, that's another thing. Not every store stocks them. That's a good point actually about availability. When someone goes into a shoe store, it's actually a real minefield now more than ever before, because the people in the shoe stores are inundated with the technical info from shoe companies. So when your athlete is going to a shoe store to get, their flats or whatever it might be, remember that they need to stick to their guns as to what they really require and not be influenced by the people in the shoe store who are then profoundly influenced from the shoe companies. And one of the shoe companies actually gives a percentage rebate back to the store and individuals in the store if they are funneled into their shoe as well with one of the chains out there. So it's very, and most of the time I always say to people who you send off to get shoes, if it gets overwhelming and confusing, or you feel like you're being swayed into something different, just call and get in touch because it is really, really hard. Yeah, I'm not sure about the sprints. All I understand is what's going on with the distance runners, Peter. Sorry. Still stuck in my distance running brain, Peter. Is there a suggested age for athletes to start using such a shoe? I don't know. You could argue probably almost straight away for stability, but yeah, I don't know.
So, Peter Fitzgerald, you've put a few things in chat. Can you unmute yourself? And is there anything else that you wanted Jason to cover or
Yeah,
respond
look,
to?
just Jason. I mean, look, and I understand most of the thing, most of the controversy and the discussions and everything go around the distance stuff. I think there's some real interesting sort of facts come out of just looking at the not necessarily the top time for the year on a world list, but the 50th top time, the 50th time each year since the sprint shoes have come in. And the average time or the 50th, the 40th to the 50th time on the world list has massively improved for both men and women since it's came in, but not necessarily the very top. The top 10, unlike the distance runners, 5, 10, 800, went crazy 2 years ago when Adidas seemed to have something else that no one else had, or it was just a coincidence they were all wearing Adidas. But the sprints, it's really quite sort of strange, but the average time that would be the 20th through to 50th, I reckon, on has massively improved, but not necessarily the top 20. Now, that may have something to do with drugs, drug testing, the historical world list. You could argue, in the top 20, there's two that you might be confident that were clean anyway. So that sort of skews it. But I have just my view is that it seems to assist women more than men, and young sprinters more than oldest, more mature sprinters. And I think it gives those lighter athletes and less developed athletes, and that's not a derisive comment about women, just saying physically they're not as strong. It seems to give them what you were talking about with the distance shoes. It gives them the ability to get up on their forefoot, stay on their forefoot. One of the great, the great
talent of a sprinter is the stiff ankle and the ballistic strength, and it gives a young sprinter that, and it gives female sprinters that, whereas it doesn't necessarily give a mature sprinter like Bolt or Gatlin, you know, who could deadlift the house anyway. It's virtually going to have, in my view, it's not going to have a lot of difference, and I think the stats show that. And the other thing, just as a comment, is there's now a whole generation of really good athletes, Gout, Myers, and this, I've just forgotten the guy, that really good 16-year-old guy from New Zealand, the distance runner, who have probably never run in standard shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's really interesting, you know, it's all right saying, oh, well, you should start them later. Gout's probably never run in anything other than the super shoes, and I would reckon Myers, whereas you know, Inga Britson probably went both sides of it, but Myers is probably hasn't, you know, in his anything like his elite career, anywhere near his elite career, probably when he was 13, 14, he probably hasn't done anything other than run in those shoes. And I think there's a group of athletes that respond better than others. And you'll never know now. The whole sport's been changed because of it, because it might even mean you've got to have different talents to be really good.
Yeah.
Thanks,
So
Andrew. It was Sam Ruth you were looking for there, Fitz.
that's the guy. And I'm sorry for machine gunning that, but
that's all right. But you know, what you're talking about is strength and then getting the assistance. That's the point you're making. Yeah.
And
And it's
I
really
just.
important. You think about the bulk of runners out there. What I think it's two. What is it? 2% of Australian runners in Australia are sort of like at national level, something like that, some figure like that. The other 98%, you know, should they be using these shoes if they're not strong? Probably not.
Go to the APS carnivals early on in the year in Victoria, and you see kids running in super shoes on grass bloody tracks. They only run for 6 weeks of the year. It's just a joke.
So
But anyway.
I hang on my points of that training and technique are the things that need to be focused on at a young age and throughout.
Okay, can we move on? Because Brett had some things in chat as well. Brett, could you unmute yourself and just say whether you've had all your items addressed or whether you want to take them further?
I'm trying to, JC, but I don't seem to be able to. Am I? Can you hear me?
Yeah,
Yeah.
we can hear you.
Jason, the availability thing wasn't the available in the stores, but I remember seeing the 2016 marathon winners. They're all in shoes from Nike that no one else could get. Now, there's also, from what I understand, prototypes of been included to some degree. What's the situation with how many shoes have to be available to the public for how long and all that sort of stuff? Or are those rules that used to apply just been put away?
Yeah, I don't know what happens with that. And I mean, from a marketing point of view, it's brilliant. They bring out a prototype, or they say it's a prototype. So he breaks the world record, and the whole world is desperate to get his shoe. Then 6 months later, it becomes available. So I don't know what happens with the prototype situation and what's allowed. And I suppose they just have to conform from a design point of view. But, well, there is an availability problem there, definitely, for everyone else other than those, you know, supported runners from a certain company. Is it unfair
Kirsten and
advantage?
Richard, are you able to respond to that, Kirsten and Richard?
I don't know the ins and outs of
I thought some
the
time ago,
prototype.
I can't remember right this very minute, I thought there was some ruling with regards to having been available for so many months and a number of shoes had to be sold or whatever beforehand. So I can't remember what it is that maybe in somewhere in the World Athletics rules. I can't remember right now, but I thought there was initially when these first came out, they had to be available to the public for so many months beforehand or whatever. But I can't remember what it is now. But there was something like that.
I can't remember the timelines either, but it was something like that.
The
So if
Andrew, you had some things on chat as well. Can you unmute yourself? And if there's anything that didn't get covered, can you ask or comment?
No, I'm okay with everything that was covered. All the points I raised were covered pretty significantly, so thank you very much.
Tony, you asked about track spikes. Unmute yourself if you want to take that conversation further.
Yes, I just wonder with, teenage, I'm thinking more 400, 800, 1500, whether, the new spikes have made any difference you feel there. I mean, we're not talking about 40 meter stack heights or anything like that.
No,
But the carbon plate seems to have made, a demonstrable difference, particularly in the 800.
I think from 800 on, you could probably argue that there's a significant effect there, or maybe we just see a difference. Once again, it's very hard to get the rocker effect if the shoe's not thick. So I think that is negated with the thickness of the shoe just being 20 mil, like that slide I had earlier. So I would think that in the thinner shoes, the carbon plate is probably much more effective than, say, the
What
stack height and the curve.
have we got any injury research on those?
Not on the spike. I'm unaware of what's happening with
No.
the
Okay.
spikes.
All right. No worries, Jason. Thanks.
I
Paul,
was
you. Oh, go.
just going to jump in there, Tony, in
Yeah.
terms of, being involved in school sport and junior sport and seeing it progress over a number of years. I would have thought the best improvement, and Jason's already touched on this, is from training and technique
Oh, absolutely. No
and the
question there.
And getting older and stronger and all sort of things like that. It'd be, gee, this is really subjective on my part, but you often see kids that 17, 18 age group running 8s and 15s, and all of a sudden they disappear, and someone will say, injured. You go, oh,
Yeah.
what they were doing, sort of thing. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, I mean, we've got a coach who I've seen have 9-year-olds pulling weight sleds.
Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, there's some good ones out there.
Oh, dear oh me.
Well, a good point to make about the spikes, though, Tony, is
No.
I think, I mean, one thing about the spikes, they will increase your load of your lower limbs, no doubt about it. You'll move more, and also they're built with a negative heel to try and get your calves really activated. And that's with the plantar aspect of the foot as well. So if you increase load in a negatively heeled shoe, even a neutrally heeled shoe, you will increase the load, and that's where you've got to gradually increase the use of your spikes, but limit the use as well until that person is old enough and strong enough. And I
We
think,
shouldn't do the whole training session in spikes, you don't think, Jason?
I think they should put them on for the 10 minutes they do their track session
Yeah,
and then
absolutely.
straight out. And they've got to do that. I mean, it's like warming up. Do your
They've
strides
also
and
got
your
to do the
flats.
work on strengthening.
Exactly. But, warm up, do your strides and your flats, throw your shoes on for your 10 minutes. So if you're doing, whatever rep session it is, it only goes for 10 or 15 minutes most of the time for a lot of people. Get out of them straight away and get back to,
Yeah, we
the
I don't
bulk of
let
anyway.
them do reps or things in their spikes of training much at all.
So unless you really have to, and there's time trials or something like that, but there's minimal time, I think, because all the spikes are built negatively heeled, and that is a massive change. And even Sarah here, we're looking at was, that's the one thing we changed in the last few months, and her problem's gone away. So, and she'll run London Diamond League this week, and she's perfectly fine. She's not,
And running well,
is not pulling a suit against New Balance out, or
yeah.
worrying about what sort of color shoe she is or what brand. It's just get on with the job and
Yeah.
just basically shut up and get on with it.
No, really, really great session, John.
Peter Fitz, I'll come back to you because Paul made comment in chat. Paul, do you want to take your conversation further? Is Paul there? Could you unmute yourself? Not there. Tony Zito had a question about javelin shoes. Tony, can you unmute yourself, please?
Yeah, it's not the shoes themselves. I'm more concerned about if I'm doing damage to young throwers because I can't find any information that sort of pertains to somebody recommending an age for kids to use javelin spikes. My concern is that understanding how that those last three steps occur and how much pressure that we're putting on the kids' hips. I can't find anybody to sort of say to me, "Oh, look, stay away from them," or to a certain age when you think that that's sort of strong enough to hold that position. That's my concern.
Yeah, I don't know, Tony, but I would put it in the same basket as the spikes. Probably limited, minimal use until people become stronger and get used to that scenario. So you don't make massive changes, they're going to have an effect
No, well, that
on the lower limb.
yeah, well, that's what I do with my lot. But then, of course, they see other athletes of their age, well, other coaches, and say, and so there's a bit of, bit of tension there. But yeah, no, thank you for that. That's all.
But it takes time, doesn't it? It takes
Yeah,
time to get
very, yeah.
strong. And like,
Especially for javelin, it's just a killer.
Yeah.
It's does a
Tony,
lot.
it's the same with kids wearing high jump shoes.
Yes,
Exactly the same
yes,
reasoning.
yeah,
If
yes.
they can wear spikes to do the events,
Yes,
regular spikes for
yes.
as long until they get to that point where, well, as a coach, you're sort of, are they strong enough? Are they jumping?
Yes,
Well, for me, I was a high jump.
yes,
It's
yeah.
jumping the heights or throwing the distances.
Yeah.
And look what's happening with the movement of their feet, and do they
Yeah.
need that extra grip on the ground?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, thank you for that.
Jason, I've got another question. You've been concentrating on the foam stuff, and that's basically been distance things, but my area's the sprints. And considering the really basic physics of it, you have to bend that plate to get the kickback from it, the kinetic.
Yes.
So are there variations where if you're a particularly strong person like Gatlin, as Fitz said, that you can get a stronger plate and therefore get more out of that plate? And they make bespoke shoes for different strengths.
Maybe they're doing that. I don't know. I really don't know. I've pulled plenty of them apart and they all look very, very similar and similar thickness. But there's an argument that you could stiffen it up for sure to get more out of it. And maybe that's part of World Athletics saying you can only have one plate in the shoe, not two.
It kind of doesn't matter if the thing's bending. If it's harder to bend, then and it's just a single plate, you're still going to get the benefit from it and
Yeah,
still
so
very strong.
exactly. But I don't know whether they make those differences or not. I haven't seen anything, and I certainly haven't read anything. Yeah, I'm unsure.
Okay, coming back to Peter Fitzgerald, you had a comment about rules, Peter?
Oh, just Brett and I talk about it all the time. We're old enough to, and obviously so are probably plenty of others listening, but in 1972, the Yanks lost the pole vault for the first time in their history, and they were pissed because Bob Seagreen couldn't use a pole that he'd been using throughout the year in America that was pre-bent. And it was banned for the Olympics because it wasn't available for 12 months all around the world for everyone to use. And that was the reason. And that was the rule at the time. Now they've changed the rule and it's now 3 months. And it says that these shoes have got to be available to the public for 3 months. But they're clearly just disregarding it. Adidas made a big thing about the fact that this shoe that they all broke the world record in London was released to the public a week or a couple of days before the event. So World
That's right.
Athletics, they changed that rule from 12 months to 3 months. Now they just totally disregard it. They disregard the rule. There's only one inference that you can draw from it, and one reason they do it, and it's got to do with a dollar sign. But the other thing is this whole thing about rules, And we're talking about, you know, you're talking the shoes and the advantage in the distance running going to the elite athletes. They only get up and motor, and it gives them that great advantage if they're on the 4 foot in the marathon where they're really running fast. Doesn't really probably help your 3 hour bloke that's running the Gold Coast Marathon. But it also just totally makes nonsense of the economic reality of world pro, the pro road running scene, for instance. They're all contracted. It doesn't matter if they get 3 months or 6 months notice. They can't, most of them can't go and wear the Adidas shoe if they're contracted to Nike or to On or to New Balance. And look, it's just me being an old fart and just absolutely ruining the day that it became an arms race rather than a foot race. And that, you know, I know we're never going to go back and we're, all that sort of stuff. And that was my little glib thing about let's just make it a manufacturer's championship. And have it like Formula One. You have the guy that's coming fifth in Formula One when he's interviewed, he just bags his own thing. And he says, I can't be competitive with the top three guys, so I reckon I can probably come fourth this weekend. And yeah, I just have a big tear. I just cry. I just think it's really sad. But anyway, that's just me.
But this is the world we're in, isn't it?
This is the world we're living in. Yeah.
That's
right.
Age, like, you know, I mean, it is marketing at its best.
But the other thing with the spikes is really thing, because different people respond to different spikes. And, you know, I was coaching Aiden Aiden Murphy in 2021, and he ran 10:37, 20.41, 46.3 about 6 weeks after his 18th birthday. He ran all the times in Nike and he got offered a Puma contract.
Yeah.
And I begged him to just try them for 6 or 8 weeks and see how he went. And he actually liked them and he ran quite well. But it was really interesting. He had the bad years and he's come back and, you know, I'm really rapt for him. He's got another coach. It's really working out really well. As soon as he lost his contract, he went back to Nike. And he's running and he's run all these fast times this year back in Nike shoes. Now, yeah, he ran almost as fast in Puma as he did in Nike, and I think there's a bit of that psychological thing, but it's a real consideration for pro athletes, which you've said with the girl that you obviously have a lot to do with, you know, changing brands, changing shoes. You chase a bit of money and, you know, you might completely wreck your career, which so I just, again, I think is really sad. But anyway.
Don't forget, like, you know, from your coaching point of view for you all, small differences have a massive effect with the repetition and the loading of running. It's that simple. So you don't want to make big changes. And if you do introduce something new, it's got to be slowly, gently, gently.
Now, Jason, can I ask, is it possible for us to get copies of your graphics so we can send them out to the participants?
Yeah, sure. You can have a copy. I'll email you the whole presentation.
Okay. And now your availability to consult and also your podcast. Would you like to advertise those?
Well, the podcast comes from the radio station episode segment I had years ago. And I just love talking to people and learning about what makes them tick. So The Champion Within is about people's, how they handle themselves to do what they do, whether it's the symphony conductor or the track athlete, it doesn't matter. It's learning about what makes these people tick and, you know, and get them to impart their interesting stories. So there's lots and lots of messages from all different people. There can be footballers, musicians, athletes, track and field athletes. There's a few track and field athletes on there, actually, which is really interesting. I think the first one was Alison Inverarity, and there's a few others there. Kath Freeman's on there, Tamsin. But it's just a podcast that is talking about, you know, not athletics. It's about just people generally as to what they get up to and what makes them tick and how they've achieved what they've done with themselves.
From a consultant, can you send me a link so I can pass it on to the participants?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'll hopefully find it interesting.
Also, we've got some people on who are not 18FCA members. So the whole deal with 18FCA is if you're an 18FCA member, you automatically become a member of the Oceania Athletics Coaches Association, which in turn is a member of the Global Athletic Coaching Academy that's headed by Frank Dick. What 18FCA offers is the accreditation through that pathway gets you recognised in all the associated countries around the world, get your accreditation, 18FCA accreditation recognised all around the world. Also, 18FCA's insurance covers you in most countries around the world, obviously countries at war, no, if you're coaching an athletic situation. You don't have to be coaching someone who's also aligned with the body, like is the case with some of the other insurance around Australia. So that's a big thing. It's an association run by coaches for coaches and their athletes. And a big highlight is Glenys puts a lot of time and effort into a quarterly journal and newsletter that comes out to our members as well, which has got heaps and heaps of information. At the Global Athletic Coaches end, they make us aware of online and in-person coach education events. Some of these are paid for attendance, and there are some that are free as well. And the next one that we're having at our branch or through our branch is on the 9th of August. And Peter, who you've heard on the session tonight, Peter Fitzgerald and his former coach Bruce Shaw are presenting a session entitled Athletics Coaching from the 1970s to Now. They're going to be talking about the evolution of coaching during that period. Both of them transitioned from athlete to coach, so they're going to talk about the issues involved in transition from athlete to coach. And Peter Fitzgerald's been a selector for both athletics and triathlon, so he's going to talk about the process and pitfalls of national selection. So we'll be getting information out about that in the next week or so. So that's coming up. I think that's all I have to say. Is there anybody else? We'll let you open your mic for the next few minutes if there's anybody else that's got something they want covered before we finish off. No? I might hand over to Lucas to do the final wrap up and thank yous then. Lucas, are you available? Lucas gone.
Can I speak for Lucas? He asked me to give his apologies. He had to leave about 3 minutes
Okay.
ago.
And Masters, thank you. So anyway, I'd like to thank Jason, Kirstein, Richard, and other people who've had input to this session. It's been really enjoyable. It was great to see so many people come on board. And I hope you've got out of it what we hope you would get out of it. And thank you for participating.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And you can email anytime. Just you can get my email through John. But yeah.
Yeah, I didn't put it out publicly
Oh, it's fine.
because I
I'm happy
wasn't.
to. No problem at all. Because when we have these sessions, often you walk away and you think about different things, or during the week you've got someone you need to know something about, and you just think about it and it's like, hey, what about this? What about that? You know. So I'm more than happy for that. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you everybody for participating. And I think,
Thank you.
Jerry, we can
Thank you.
stop the recording now. Thank you.
All right.
Could the
Thank you.
people.
Bye, everyone.